This is the Friday edition of the Large Morning Show in the afternoon on the Big 550 KTRS. This portion of the show brought to you by Window World, the number one replacement window company in the United States. You can get them right here in St. Louis at windowworldstlouis.com. I am Paul Harris, Ian Geis, and Dan Strauss here in the studio with me. Normally, we'd be joined in the studio by our news director, Colin Jeffrey, who switches to his alter ego of Showbiz Boy. But today, he has switched to his other alter ego. I guess that's his alter ego. And that is, I'm on vacation. Why are you calling me, boy? He is in Dallas, Texas today and on the phone. Hi, Colin. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you, Paul?
Good. Just taking a couple of days, or is this an extended Thanksgiving vacation for you?
No, just pre-Thanksgiving. Go down to see my parents.
Okay. Well, I hope you have a nice time there. I'm glad you could join us on the phone here today. In your absence, I've asked somebody else to sit in your chair. I hope you don't mind.
That sounds good.
Lynn Venhouse is here today. Lynn has written for a lot of newspapers in the St. Louis area. Right now, she's a contributing writer covering movies and showbiz and theater for the Belleville News Democrat. And I ran into Lynn at one of the press screenings recently. And afterwards, we had a long talk about a movie in the lobby. And because Lynn has a personal connection to the subject of the movie, I've asked her to join us here today. Hi, Lynn. Thanks for coming in.
Hi. Thank you for inviting me.
Nice to have you here. The movie we're going to talk about, Colin, is Spotlight. And we're going to get to this, and then I know you have the one that's going to be the huge box office winner this weekend, which is Hunger Games: Mockingjay Part 2, right?
Yes, we're going to do these in inverse order of societal importance here.
Yeah, that's probably true. Spotlight is a movie that does have a lot of societal impact because it is the story of the reporters at the Boston Globe who uncovered the pedophile priest scandal in 2001. And I will tell you right now, along with Inside Out, it's the best movie of the year. I gave Inside Out a 10 out of 10, and you were shocked at that, Colin.
Yeah, I really liked it quite a bit, but not 10 yet.
So my feeling was I couldn't think of anything that was wrong with that movie, and I felt the same way when I walked out of Spotlight. I'm giving it a 10 out of 10. I'm giving you the lead right here. I'm not going to bury the lead. I'm telling it to you right up front. And this movie is phenomenal. Let me just tell you the cast of this movie. Michael Keaton, Mark Ruffalo, Rachel McAdams, John Slattery, Liev Schreiber, Stanley Tucci, a guy by the name of Brian Darcy James, who you haven't seen in movies before, but he's in it. Terrific. It is also, I think, the best movie about journalism since All the President's Men. Lynn, you've been in the newspaper business for a long time, and this is about newspaper people. What did you think of it from the professional perspective?
I agree with you. They get it right. They get all the digging, all the legwork, all the trying to get dot the I's and cross the T's, and just the whole way they go about it was just spot on.
Yeah.
And the also in the newsroom, how the newsroom works.
What's amazing about this Spotlight team at the Boston Globe who did all this digging was that they were allowed the time to do that digging, because they go on for months and months and months. And I want to play you a clip from the movie this, with Mark Ruffalo, who plays a reporter, part of the Spotlight team, named Mike Resendez, and Michael Keaton, who played Walter Robbie Robinson, who was the editor of the Spotlight team. And you'll hear references to Cardinal Law, who was the cardinal of the Boston Archdiocese at the time. And you'll hear reference to Marty Baron, who was at that time the new editor-in-chief of the Boston Globe. This is Mike Resendez and Walter Robinson discussing whether the story should go into print when they haven't put anything in the newspaper about it yet. They've already worked on it for weeks. And Mike Resendez wants to get this thing in the paper, but he gets some pushback from Robbie.
We got law. This is it.
No, this is law covering for one priest. There's another 90 out there.
Yeah, and we'll print that story when we get it, but we got to go with this now.
No, I'm not going to rush the story, Mike.
But we don't have a choice, Robbie. If we don't rush to print, somebody else is going to find these letters and butcher this story. Joe Quimby from the Herald was at the freaking courthouse.
Mike.
What? Why are we hesitating? Barron told us to get law. This is law.
Barron told us to get the system. We need the full scope. That's the only thing that will put an end to this.
So let's take it up to Ben. Let him decide.
We'll take it to Ben when I say it's time.
It's time, Robbie. It's time. They knew, and they let it happen. Two kids. Okay? It could have been you. It could have been me. It could have been any of us. We gotta nail these scumbags. We gotta show people that nobody can get away with this. Not a priest or a cardinal or a freaking pope.
Boy, the passion in there, you know that that passion was there in the actual reporters, because these actors went and talked to all the reporters who they were playing and got to know them and really turned them into the characters that we see on the screen. And holy cow, just hearing that clip drew me back into the movie again.
It did. It just shows you the importance of investigative journalism. But nowadays, people wouldn't have that much time. Teams wouldn't have that much time to do that. But the fact that the editor wanted to go higher and get the system and not just report on just one case, because initially they thought it was 12, 13 priests, and then it turned into 90.
Mm-hmm.
And then also 9/11 happened, so they had to push it back. But they were so methodical and meticulous. It just shows you how they knew how big this was. And they didn't want anybody to beat them, but they had to get it right.
And Colin, you know, being in the news business yourself, there's no such thing as long-form thinking, particularly in the internet age, right?
No, it's really rare. In fact, one of the few sites that I use for it is a site called Long Form, and they publish and republish long form journalism. And in fact, this week today, I got in my inbox, they're saying, we need donations because this is really tough to keep going. I mean, that's how tough it is. Here's a place that does not exist brick and mortar. It's entirely online, and they're saying, we're running out of money to do this. So, yeah, I can only imagine for newspapers where the budget is being pinched more and more. I mean, it's just difficult to imagine anyone being given the leash that they need to finish this.
Yeah, I mean, the Post-Dispatch doesn't have a long-form editorial team anymore, do they?
No, they do not even have a religion editor anymore.
So if this story were breaking now, you know what, let's talk about breaking the story, because this movie, Spotlight, so great, is about the Boston Globe's investigation of the pedophile priests in Boston in 2001, and they published it in January of 2002 and continued to write several hundred stories about it in 2002 as well. They didn't just put out one story, but they kept on going with it after that. But Lynn, you were on a similar story when you were working for the Centralia Sentinel in 1993 at the Belleville Archdiocese, right?
Right. The Belleville Diocese has a wide range. They have 127 parishes, and it goes like Sparta, Salem, and down south to some of the, you know, really southern counties in Illinois. So it's not just Belleville.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, March 5th, 1993, they removed a parish pastor from his church, which was Blessed Sacrament Church in Belleville, which happened to be my home parish when I grew up.
Mm-hmm.
And I get a call from actually somebody at the Belleville News Democrat asking me if my mom was there, if she knew anything about it. And I said, actually, she's here. And then my brother-in-law said that this Father Roderman had been the principal at Mater Dei, and that unleashed a floodgate, and that was my territory. So I started digging. And what I found out was, I mean, it was pretty horrific, but there was so much cover-up. And then that whole year, as I was writing stories just based on the parishes that were in my newspaper territory, the Belleville News Democrat and the St. Louis Post-Dispatch were also covering this story. 9 priests in all were removed that year, but total for a couple of years after that. So it's a total of 15. The Belleville Diocese has 110 priests, so that was over 10% of the priests were removed.
Now, when you say they were removed, do you mean that they were taken out of their parishes
Yes. And
moved to another one?
No, they were put on administrative leave, because that had been happening for years. As I uncovered this story, we found so many people that had covered this up, because there were 3 bishops that moved around, Father Raymond Kaunaki, and he was in 6 parishes, had abused lots of children, and he got a woman pregnant, and she and her family had gone to the diocese in 1973. He was not removed till around 1995.
Wow.
Yes.
And so there was this pattern of cover-ups.
Yes.
That you were covering here, and the Globe in Boston then covered 8 years later. And, of course, we've heard about them all over the country. And as a matter of fact, at the end of Spotlight, there's a list of the cities where the pedophile priest cover-up and scandal broke out, and it goes on and on and on. You cannot believe how long the list is, and the thousands of priests and hundreds of thousands of people who were molested by these men. It's shocking.
It is shocking, and that's why SNAP, you've had David Clossie on your show, and he continues. He's a national director, but he lives in St. Louis, and he continues. In fact, when I was writing, because the Centralia paper is a small paper, and I was writing about what was happening, and he contacted me, and he said, you're the only one that's writing about this. What's going on, and I want to talk to you, and he was giving me lots of information, and then everybody else started getting on board, because the key was finding out about the first priest that was removed, his backstory, and that had gone to 1969. He was on a houseboat in Carlisle Lake, and there were students from Modern Day High School on there, and something happened. They won't tell me. They won't talk about it, but they said they jumped out into the lake and swam back to shore.
Wow.
And their parents went to Bishop Zerwist at the time, and he did nothing but move Father Roderman out of Modern Day High School, put him somewhere else. And the parents, I just happened to know some of the kids involved and some of the parents, and that's who I was talking to when we found out that the diocese was paying off one of the people involved, and that had led to Father Roderman getting removed from Blessed Sacrament. So it's a very tangled web. It goes for so much. There is a website called bishop-accountability.org, and it lists all the priests in America that have been removed from parishes. So far, the only one in the Belleville Diocese to actually be defrocked by the Pope is Father Vonneman, and he was in charge of Camp Anasank for many years, and he had a lawsuit brought against him that for $3.5 million, a civil lawsuit. But this Kanaki that I just referred to, he had the biggest settlement, a $6.2 million he got a couple years ago.
The bottom line when you talk about a settlement is the church was paying people off.
Right.
You know, here, if you don't say anything about this, we'll give you this money, or we'll move these guys. Were there criminal charges filed? Was anybody ever sent to jail for any of this?
No. No. It's
boys
just
are being raped, and nobody went to jail.
Right. It's just civil. Civil.
And that's the huge cover-up.
I know. And in fact, what I hope about Spotlight is it's going to reignite this issue again, because...
Yeah.
There was a verdict November 6th, and it involved a priest that had been in Belleville and in other places. He had been in charge of an orphanage in Peoria, Illinois, for years with 40 kids. And they don't name the victim, but they just gave $8 million to the victim, and he was an oblate. And so he wasn't exactly a parish diocesan priest in Belleville, but he was at parishes in Belleville. And they're saying these bishops should be at fault for moving these priests when people were coming to them and telling them these things. Father Grogan, Clyde Grogan, he's an excellent, outstanding priest. First of all, there are really good priests, and I know some really fantastic priests. So it's not everybody. It's just, and they want the molesters, and they want the bad eggs out, because it gives them such a bad name, and everybody's suspect, and the parishioners are angry and hurt, and there's this level of suspicion. So they want the bad priest to be removed.
I know David Clossie from SNAP, the Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests, was at the press screening that you and I attended.
Yes.
He ran out before I could say anything to him afterwards. Have you had a chance to talk to him? What did he say about the movie?
Yes, I have. He thought it was fantastic. He had two other people with him, two SNAP members. One is an attorney who's still working on cases, and one was a woman who I later found out her son had killed himself after all this abuse. Because the victims go through so much shame and emotional distress and psychological turmoil that it's very hard for them to deal with it. But the beauty of this story, as tragic as it is, it makes them come forward now because they know they're not alone. They know that people will listen to them, and they can be have a safe environment to tell their story. Because Father Vonneman told the boy that wound up suing him for $3.5 million that if he told his parents about this. He was going to kill his favorite horse, and he was going to set a building on fire and blame him.
Wow. That's just pure evil.
It is.
That's pure evil.
It is.
Is it still going on?
No, he like I said, he was defrocked.
No, not just him. Oh. I'm just talking about, are there still molesters?
Well, I think with this case that just got settled November 6th, this was just settled 2 weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
And there it was, Father J. Vincent Fitzgerald, and he had been, like I said, at the orphanage, and he was in Belleville for 16 years. And so people are still coming forward.
It's a horrible, horrible subject, but a remarkable movie. I led by saying I'm giving it a 10 out of 10 and calling it, along with Inside Out, the best movie of the year. Would you agree?
Oh, I agree. And what's beautiful about it, too, is it covers every angle. It covers the church. It covers the devout parishioners who were so upset about this because they did not want to believe it. And when Rachel McAdams goes to her grandmother and shows her the story for the first time,
yeah,
and has her read it, because parishioners reacted very strongly to this. And there are people to this day that don't want to believe it. But even though our case happened in 93, when Boston came out, that was a huge turnaround for people. People started believing that, hey, this goes on.
Yep.
And so that's why I think Boston's case was so fantastic, because it got people to move forward. You know, it got victims to say, oh, I cannot be silent. I have to come forward. And that's why you have all those, that scroll after the movie of all those places, because this is the case that, you know, opened that up. But there are so many. David Klossy's busy all the time with these incidents.
What I find interesting about this, in addition to the subject matter and the brilliance of the movie, is that the real-life reporters, the people who worked on that Spotlight team, like you, Catholics.
Yes.
All were connected to the Catholic Church, attended Catholic Church, had families who were quite religious. I mean, Boston, like St. Louis, a very Catholic town. And so it wasn't just a matter of shaking things up. It was also a matter of going up against one of the most powerful institutions in town. I want to play another clip from this movie. This is with a wonderful character actor named Paul Guilfoyle, who plays a guy who, you know, he kind of runs Catholic charities in Boston. And he's very, very high up, and kind of does public relations stuff and contact stuff for Cardinal Law back in 2001. And he has a meeting with Walter Robbie Robinson, played by Michael Keaton, in a bar. And it goes like this.
You get a lot of people here respect you, Robbie.
Yeah, the work you do.
That's good to know.
You know, it's because you care about this place.
Yeah.
It's why you do what you do. It's who you are. You know, but people need the church more than ever right now. You know, you can feel it. And the Cardinal, he might not be perfect, but we can't throw out all the good he's doing over a few bad apples. Now, you know, I'm bringing this up to you because I know this is Barron's idea, his agenda. I got to tell you, I mean, honest to God, I mean, he doesn't care about the city the way we do. I mean, how could he?
This is how it happens, isn't it, Pete?
What's that?
Guy leans on a guy, and suddenly the whole town just looks the other way.
So powerful.
It is, because that's what happened, because people just felt like, oh, this is just isolated incidents. This didn't happen. And they wanted to sweep it under the rug and make it go away. But another thing, too, besides all the children being molested, because now they have that Protect God's Children, that's an actual program. There were adults, too, that were involved in this, because Father Joseph Schwegel, he was actually Monsignor. Monsignor Joseph Schwegel, he resigned because he admitted he was a sex addict, but he was arrested at several rest stops, the one actually by the Jefferson Barracks Bridge. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that was trying to pick up people. So it wasn't just involved with children. But the bad thing about no abuse is good, obviously. But the most horrible thing about the kids is they would invite them over. They would provide liquor to the underage kids. They would show them pornography. They would buy them gifts. One of the priests set up a dark room in the rectory for one of the kids who liked photography, and they would have this pattern of behavior. And the movie Spotlight brings up the pattern of behavior when those kids, those adult victims, talk about how the priests were able to have trust with them, because they were from devout families, but they were also maybe from homes that the priests paying attention to them was a good thing.
Yeah, because not only are they an authority figure, they are supposedly their moral guides. I mean, there was no morality in these men whatsoever. It's a phenomenal movie. It's called Spotlight. Lynn, thank you for all the work that you did on the story.
Sure.
22 years ago, and for reminding us of some of the details of it here today, and for coming in. I really appreciate it.
Sure, I'm happy to help, and I really hope this movie saves jobs for journalism, which would be a good thing, and then also opens up some of these, and dialogue with people, too.
Well, the latter part, I think, is very important and is going to happen. Unfortunately, I don't think we're going to see a newspaper journalism boom like we did after All the President's Men. A lot of people went into the business because they saw Dustin Hoffman and Robert Redford as Carl Bernstein and Bob Woodward in the movie and said, now I want to go into that field. I don't think you're going to see a lot of kids who are in college now, even the ones at the J School at Mizzou, saying, I want to go work for a newspaper which has no money and doesn't do any investigative reporting. That's just not going to happen.
Yeah, and trim staffs.
Yeah.
It's true. But it does show the importance of journalism in our society.
Absolutely. Lynn Venhouse writes for the Belleville News Democrat. Thanks so much for joining us here today.
Well, thank you very much.
Colin, I'm going to take a break. When we come back, we'll get to you in The Hunger Games, Mockingjay Part 2. And I'll talk a little bit about this new Bryan Cranston movie, Trumbo. So stand by. It's the Friday edition of the Large Morning Show in the afternoon. I'm a Big 550 KTRS. I am Paul Harris. Dan Strauss and Ian Geis here in the studio with me. And Colin Jeffrey is in Dallas on vacation with his family for the weekend. And I realized that I was talking so much with Lynn that I didn't give you much of a chance to jump in there. Colin, I apologize.
No, that's fine. It's really interesting to listen to, actually. And, that sounds like quite the movie. I'm looking forward to seeing it.
The movie, again, if you missed the first segment of this hour, the movie's called Spotlight. Fantastic movie about the investigative reporters who exposed the pedophile priest in Boston in 2001. I gave it a 10 out of 10, along with Inside Out, the only movies this year that I ranked that high. Now, the bad news is that's not going to be seen by nearly as many people who are going to see Jennifer Lawrence and her bow and arrow this weekend, right?
No.
Is that what she calls them?
Bow and arrows?
No, I'd say they're aiming for different audiences. We'll put it nicely.
Yeah.
They finally wrap up part 4 here of the Hunger Games quadrilogy, because they did what proved to be so profitable for Harry Potter, and that's they broke the final book up into 2 movies.
So you get Hunger Games, Mockingjay, Part 2.
Exactly. And so, as you might expect with something Part 2 in the title, you should probably see Part 1 beforehand, especially because this drops you in almost mid-scene from where the first one ends, Part 1 ends. So if you haven't seen that, I can't imagine you would go see this, but you may want to, in fact, rewatch the previous one, because it's literally mid-scene. If you're unfamiliar with this entirely, congratulations, you've avoided this movie somehow. But it's based off a young adult novel. I don't particularly encourage adults to read novels that are geared for 13-year-olds. However, these movies hit on what made those novels successful, and that is it's kind of subversive. Whether or not you realize this, by the time this fourth movie ends, what you've been shown is a look that, regardless of what seems to be right and wrong and evil, war is controlled by a very small group of people, and they use heroes as propaganda to shape the dialogue of this war, although not much changes when it's all said and done. And that's the arc. The first half, Mockingjay Part 1, is very walky and talky. They're sort of setting it up. this is all action, which would be good, except the director of this, Francis Lawrence, does not know how to shoot action.
Mm.
And that is its biggest... The best way I can think is you to describe this is you see an action scene and you're not quite certain what happened until you see the next scene and you can do a quick check to see who's still alive and there. Like, that's a problem when you have a movie that is over 2 hours and is, I would say, safely 60 to 70% action.
Mm.
When you can't tell what's happening for 60 to 70% of the movie until the next scene comes on, that is a major issue. That being said, it's still fun to go see. It may not sound like a perfect holiday movie, you know, kids killing one another in a nationally televised sport and leading an insurrection on the president, but it's fun. Maybe not Thanksgiving material. I kind of question that it comes out this weekend, but it's got that going for it. It's a big blockbuster in the fall when there's not really a lot of competition. I guess Bond is there, but this is going to blow Bond out of the water. And it's a better movie than Bond was.
Does it have the same cast?
It has an enormous cast. I can't even go through everyone. Liam Hemsworth is probably one of the biggest names outside of Jennifer Lawrence, but he's awful. Julianne Moore is in it. She's pretty good, but in it for a very small amount. This is one of Phil Seymour Hoffman's last roles, and his character is essentially thrown to the side, which is sad to see. Donald Sutherland plays President Snow, who's the main villain. He's in it, but again, not quite enough. It really centers around Jennifer Lawrence and Josh Hutcherson and Liam Hemsworth as kind of the love triangle at the center of this whole series. It's depressing. It's not an uplifting movie. And it's shot in a very monochromatic style, which I'm not a huge fan of. It works out all right here, but it gets kind of bleary looking at the screen in shades of blue for 2 hours and 17 minutes. So that's not great, but again, it's sort of a satisfying conclusion. If you've been up on these movies, you will enjoy this. And I really don't advocate young adult books for adults, but this is something where you can sit through these movies and you will probably pick up on something different than a 13-year-old would.
All right. On a scale of 10, what do you give it?
It's a solid 6.
6 out of 10 for Hunger Games: Mockingjay Part 2, which I think is probably a critic-proof movie. No matter what we say about it, it's still going to go huge at the box office this weekend.
Yeah, the first three movies have grossed on their opening weekend a combined $425 million, I believe. So this is going to be another big weekend, $120 million plus.
Wow.
Yeah.
Now, there are a bunch of other movies opening this weekend, and I just want to ask you about them because I haven't seen any of them, and I don't think you went to the screenings for them either. One of them is the new Seth Rogen comedy, The Night Before. What do you know about that?
This is three lifelong friends meet up before Christmas every year, but now one of them is becoming famous, another one is getting married, and they're not going to be able to do this. So they get together one last time looking for the best Christmas party in New York City. The only hitch is two of the three are Jewish. And it's a crazy night. So if you like Seth Rogen being wacky with Joseph Gordon-Levitt and Anthony Mackie, go check it out.
You know, they were good. Rogen and Levitt were good in 50-50 a few years ago.
Yes. I don't think there's going to be a lot of heart in this. And so far as I know, no one is battling cancer.
Okay. How about a movie called Secret in Their Eyes?
This centers around a group of investigators, and they are torn apart when one of their teenage daughters was murdered. I haven't heard anything good about it, but it has Chiwetel Ejiofor, Nicole Kidman, Julia Roberts, and was directed by the guy who wrote the first Hunger Games. So, I don't know.
Lynn,
I'd say there's probably better ways to spend your money.
Lynn was telling me before she walked out of here that she saw this movie and she couldn't believe what's happened to Nicole Kidman's face.
Yeah.
Maybe she got over Botox or something. She has no expressions on her face at all.
Yeah. Not a good look.
Okay. There's another movie coming out this weekend called Brooklyn. What about that?
This is a romance, just a dyed-in-the-wool romance. It centers around an Irish immigrant who comes to Brooklyn, gets a job, falls in love, and then is called back to Ireland by her mother because everyone else in her family has died. This centers in the 1950s, and so she has a choice to make: stay in Ireland and comfort her grieving mother or return to her love in Brooklyn, half a world away.
Okay.
There you go.
All right. Aww. Can't really review it because we haven't seen that, but I do have one other movie opening this weekend, which I did see and which I liked a lot. It's a movie called Trumbo. Bryan Cranston plays the lead character, Dalton Trumbo. Now, this is based on a real guy and a real story. In 1947, Dalton Trumbo was the highest-paid screenwriter in Hollywood, which I guess means he was the highest-paid screenwriter in the world, because that's where movies have always been made. But the problem for him at that time was that McCarthyism was beginning up, and even though we were after World War II, we were in the midst of the Cold War, and we had people screaming about communists, and particularly in Washington, D.C., where the House of Representatives went on a witch hunt with something called the House Un-American Activities Committee, and they went after Hollywood at a certain point. And they particularly went after Dalton Trumbo and some people like him who were members of the Communist Party of the United States. And these politicians decided that they were going to be in charge of what people think and what people write and what people do. Frankly, a lot of the rhetoric that you heard from them, and which you hear in this movie, wasn't all that different from the nonsense that we've been hearing over the last week or even over the last several years. But Dalton Trumbo was one of 10, the Hollywood 10, they were called, and he was sent to jail for contempt of Congress. Not for any other crime, but because when he went to Congress, he wouldn't name names and he wouldn't cooperate with the House Un-American Activities Committee, and so he was sent to prison. When he got out of prison, he still had a life he had to support. He had a wife, who in the movie is played by Diane Lane, who I've always loved. He has three kids, the oldest of which is played by Elle Fanning. That's the teenage daughter. Elle Fanning is very, very good in this movie. Louis C.K. is also in the movie, playing Arlen Heard, who's a composite of some of the other writers who are friends and colleagues of Trumbo and who are also blacklisted. Helen Mirren plays Hedda Hopper, who was a columnist at the time, at a time when newspaper columnists had real power. If she wrote something about you, it stuck. And she particularly was a real red baiter and would go after people in Hollywood and elsewhere and destroyed careers and, in some cases, lives with what she wrote. She is in this movie. John Goodman is also in the movie as a guy by the name of Frank King, who, with his brother Jaime, who's played by Stephen Root, they hired Dalton Trumbo and Arlen Heard and some of these other guys who'd been blacklisted and had them write kind of cheapo movies for them without using their actual name. So they would use a pseudonym and still be able to make money. Not as much money as he was making in 1947, but then eventually other people got on to the idea of having blacklisted writers use a front, maybe get somebody else to pretend that they had written the story or to write it under a pseudonym. And so other studios started hiring Trumbo and others. And Trumbo, while blacklisted, wrote the screenplays for two movies that won the Academy Award for Best Screenplay. One of them was Roman Holiday, and the other one was The Brave One. And this movie shows you that. There are also interesting performances in here by Michael Stuhlbarg, who was in the Steve Jobs movie. Not as Steve Jobs, but as one of the programmers in the movie. In this movie, he plays Edward G. Robinson, who was good friends with Dalton Trumbo and was a major, major movie star, and he got caught up in the whole blacklisting thing. There's also an actor by the name of David James Elliott, who plays John Wayne, who has also a central role in this story. And then there's a guy by the name of Dean O'Gorman, who I've never heard of before, and you may never hear of again. He was cast entirely because he looks exactly like a young Kirk Douglas. And in the movie, he plays a young Kirk Douglas. And Kirk Douglas has a very important role to play in Dalton Trumbo's life later on and helped to break the blacklist with a movie he made called Spartacus. I'm not giving too much of this movie away here when I tell you all of the details that I've given you, because it is still a thrilling movie to sit through and a movie that may anger you if you think that perhaps government shouldn't be telling us what we think, what we write, what we listen to, what we read, etc. I give Trumbo an 8 out of 10. It has a couple of slow moments that take some things away from it. It's not as good a movie as Spotlight, but it is very, very, very good. And it opens in St. Louis this weekend as well.
Sounds great.
So are we missing anything for this weekend, or is that pretty much it?
There's just one thing I want to make certain people are aware of. We spoke about equal time after Donald Trump hosted Saturday Night Live. Oh, NBC yeah. has come out and said they are going to offer candidates 12 minutes of airtime. The first two candidates are not only going to get 12 minutes of local airtime at a 9 o'clock hour coming up on Friday, November 28th, but NBC is saying they're going to give them 12 minutes during the SNL broadcast on November 28th. There are 14 candidates, so 13 of them, I guess, are 12 minutes apiece. That would be one very long, very dry Saturday Night Live.
Yeah, I don't think they're all doing it, but I know that maybe three or four of them have gone to the network and said, hey, I want my equal time.
And yeah, so, it's up to five now. Yeah, so we'll see.
Yeah. Boy, you're right. That'll be some compelling television.
Yeah. Maybe they'll write them all into a script.
No.
Into a Saturday Night Live?
Into sketches. No, I think they're going to have one of them do 12 minutes. Okay, thank you. And then the next one comes out and does 12 minutes. I don't think it's going to be wacky comedy sketch time. I don't think they're going to be sitting there as the drunk uncle on update.
Oh, good grief.
I don't think there'll be any of that stuff. Hmm. All right, Colin, you and the family, enjoy your weekend in Dallas, and I'll catch up with you after Thanksgiving.
Thank you. You too.
That's Colin Jeffrey. I'm Paul Harris. This is the Big 550 KTRS.